This is an ABC podcast.
Things are changing in the world of teenage behaviour. According to David Gillespie, the typical addictive behaviours that we associate with that phase of life, like smoking and drinking, drug taking, sex leading to teen pregnancy, all those things are in steep decline. But the downside is that a whole new set of addictions have taken their place. And before I even say what they are, you already know what I'm talking about, don't you? David Gillespie has got some big claims to make in his new book. He says that the generation that's grown up with the iPhone and with social media is different, that their neurochemical reward pathways have been profoundly rewritten by those things. He says that almost without thinking, teenagers have been given access to all of the world's most addictive dopamine buttons on a 24/7 basis. Online games and social media sites are designed with addiction in mind. And this is why so many of the people who run these companies that make them won't let their own children use them. David Gillespie is a lawyer and a researcher who takes on subjects that have become points of tension in modern life and in his own life. And he brings his forensic skills to find out for himself what's really going on. David's new book is called Teen Brain: Why Screens Are Making Your Teenager Depressed, Anxious, and Prone to Lifelong Addictive Illnesses, and How to Stop It. Wow. Hello, David.
G'day.
Lots of big claims in this, but nonetheless, I'm sure this is ringing quite a few bells with people. What kind of stories are you hearing at the moment from parents who want to restrict screen time for their kids?
Within our own family, to start with, our kids are like every other kid. They have access to devices because their school requires them to. Their mother, Lizzie, my wife, has always had a big problem with that and has always been very tough on them, not because she's basing that on any kind of evidence, just, I guess, a feeling that she doesn't like the way her kids behave when they have these screens, in that when you try to take them away from them, there's a fight. You try to keep them away from them, there's an even bigger fight. That set off all the alarm bells for her. Now, I admittedly have been a bit of a soft touch when it comes to that, and put it into the category of kids these days. I was just as bad with the Cisco kid when I was a kid.
The Cisco kid? Wow, that's going back a bit, man.
Yeah, wow. Black and white telly. And I put it down to that and felt that she was over anxious about something that probably wasn't that big a deal. But she insisted that I look at the science. She said, you do everything else based on evidence, look at the evidence on this, and you tell me then, once you've done that, that there's nothing different here. That's what pushed me into looking at this. And I've got to say, now that I have much more of a backbone, let's say. There is a very real danger here, and it has made sure that I enforce it. But along the way, as part of writing all of this down, I spoke to an awful lot of parents, and some of the stories I would get were absolutely mind-boggling. One parent told me of a friend of his is a member of a local football club and saw the neighbour to the club, their house is next to the club, saw one morning as he was working on the grounds there, the mother come out the back door of a house and hurl an Xbox into the swimming pool, followed shortly by a fully clothed school uniformed teenage boy who went in after it.
What, to save the
to
Xbox?
To save the Xbox.
To save the drowning
That's
Xbox.
That's right, the drowning Xbox.
Wow,
yeah.
Fully clothed into
fully
the pool.
Fully clothed, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, my own kids, certainly the reactions when I've restricted screen time has been weird. It's been odd and uncharacteristic in both of them. And talking about this with a colleague of mine here in the ABC, she told me that she told her 11-year-old son that he was not to go on the iPad before school. And he burst into tears and said, I paid for that iPad. And she went, wow, what's that? That is very, very odd. I mean, one comment I get when I'm talking about this with my own kids is that my daughter, she'll go, oh, you're just old, Dad, and you don't understand. You get that a lot?
Oh, all the time. Absolutely. But this is very different. We've had computers in our house. I think our house was probably one of the first to have computers. I remember an Apple IIe in our living room when I was a teenager in the 80s. We've had computers in our house for a very, very long time. But that's very different to what we're seeing now. These are highly portable devices that can travel with the kid anywhere. often in their bedroom, often out of sight of parents. You could have, if you were minded to, uploaded a nude selfie in 1987, but you would have had to do it in your lounge room in front of your family. It's a very different experience now. These highly portable devices loaded with highly engineered software, which is purposely designed to addict, is a very different scenario to even 20 or 30 years ago.
Well, is it really? I mean, that's the thing, I suppose. As I'm hearing this stuff from kids, you know, you think, well, maybe they've got a point. I mean, you and I, our generation, watched tons of television, and that was deeply alarming to our parents way back when. Right, tons and tons. The portability hardly mattered if you're sitting there rooted to the spot.
Well, yes, but you could have been the greatest Brady Bunch fan in the world, but you saw half an hour of it, and then you had to wait a week for the next episode. There's a natural gap. Now, when we're talking about addiction and the human brain, we're talking about biochemistry that can reset. And the natural gap causes a reset. Yes, you find it interesting. Yes, you want to watch the next episode of The Brady Bunch. But no, you can't watch it for another week. That natural gap in television takes it from merely very interesting when you remove the gap to addictive when you can stream every episode ever made on a live streaming service.
Yeah, but, you know, it was actually more like Scooby-Doo followed by Get Smart, followed by The Brady Bunch, followed by Bewitched, followed by I Dream of Jeannie, followed by this and that. I mean, so there was huge chunks of TV time and in our childhood. So yes. Are they different from us?
No, it is the same biochemistry at work. It's just opportunity. Watching television, watching entertainment is certainly entrancing, is certainly addictive. And parents from our generation would probably have stories to tell of removing television from a child's life and having to deal with the consequences. One of the ladies I spoke to as part of this told me that her father used to travel frequently on business trips. And when he would travel, he would pack the television into the boot of his car and take it out to the airport where he parked his car when he went away on business trips. So the whole family, I really felt for the poor mother, is left at home, no television because it was in the boot of the car at the airport.
Probably blessed relief. Let's get into the data on this. You talk about, first of all, teenagers. What do you mean by teenager? This is more than what, 13 to 19, is it strictly speaking?
Yeah, so teenagers is really shorthand for it. The phase of brain development we're talking about commences at puberty. So for girls, that's going to be around 11 and a half on average, and for boys, it's going to be around 12 and a half and finishes about 10 years later, so in the early 20s. So it's more accurate to refer to them as adolescents, but teenagers is close enough.
And what have you learned about the development of the human brain during those years?
A really interesting data is now emerging on what exactly goes on in the brain at that time. MRI technology has lent a lot in this area. The studies that I talk about are very, very recent in that respect. And what they show us is that in order to commence puberty, we have to turn off a braking system called GABA, G-A-B-A, which is, in fact, what stops us entering puberty as soon as we're born. If it were not for GABA, we would enter puberty immediately. Some hardware has to be built first before that can happen, so the brain keeps it shut down, and then the braking system goes off and allows us to enter puberty. The problem with that is that GABA is a general-purpose braking system, and it is also, besides what's stopping us enter puberty, it's what stops us becoming addicted to things that are merely rewarding. The human brain is hardwired to find some things rewarding, things that will ensure there is another generation of humans. So sex, food, the company of other humans, because as predators go, we're pretty puny, but put us in a group of cooperating humans and we're pretty powerful. Those three things in particular are particularly rewarding for humans.
So you're saying then that during puberty is this period when the final bit of brain architecture is being constructed.
That's right.
And while it's being constructed,
the braking system is turned off.
And the human brain is more open to addictive tendencies?
It's more open to reward turning into addiction. So things that were merely rewarding as a child turn into addictive once the braking system is turned off. Because what the suppressing effect of GABA is it dials down the effect of dopamine induction, which is the things that cause addiction. It normally would just shut that down in a child and it shuts it down in an adult. But in this particularly vulnerable phase, when the braking system is turned off in the human brain, it allows it to keep going.
So this is why traditionally, if that's the word for it, teenagers would say, once they became teenagers, would go, cigarettes and alcohol, where have you been all my life? Is that what you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Because whilst they were merely interesting before, they become addictive. The problem with that is that once you're addicted to one thing, There's a gateway effect that makes it easier for you to become addicted to something else, and it makes it more likely that you will be lifeline addicted to either the thing that started you or one of those something else's. Much higher probabilities of lifelong addiction if the addiction first commences during that phase. So it's a uniquely susceptible phase in human development. And it's necessary because in order to grow the front part of our brain,
the prefrontal cortex,
the bit that manages all our higher order thinking, manages our interactions with others, our impulse control, our social control, our risk assessment, our decision making, all of that stuff is being developed during that phase. And in order for it to be developed, the braking system must be turned off. Now, that hasn't been a problem in a society where addiction wasn't so available.
Addictive substances,
behaviours weren't so available. So if we dial back to sort of the 19th century, teenagers were not having access to much that was potentially addictive. Perhaps alcohol, if they were lucky, although they probably weren't wasting much of that on teenagers either. And beyond that, there just wasn't much there. There were no high-speed simulators of sex or approval or danger. None of that occurred. If we dial through to the 1960s, 70s, 80s, suddenly we have substances which can simulate the same sort of feelings in the human brain, and the adventurous few were becoming addicted. Dial through to now, and we're giving every kid, access to electronic devices that can run simulators of addictive behaviour all the time.
So these are teenage patterns of addiction to substances like cigarettes, alcohol, cocaine, heroin,
yep,
sex, whatever, everything else. What happened to them around about 15 years ago?
It's actually more recent than that. So between 2007 and 2010, all of the rates of those things have dropped off a cliff. So if you compare the rate of, say, teenage sex or teenage pregnancy or alcoholism or cigarette addiction, all of those things, compare the rate in 2007 to now, it is now about half what it was.
Half.
So it is an extraordinary drop. It is something that no public health campaign could ever have achieved.
How do we know this? What's the data on this? Why aren't we more talking about this more often? I mean, this seems extraordinary to me.
Well, I don't know why we're not talking about it. It was shocking to me. I had to triple check, and my fact checkers had to check it, and everything. It just seems so counterintuitive. We have so many people telling us all the time that these things are a growing problem, when the reality is that they are less of a problem now than they have ever been. And the data for this comes from really reliable sources. Large scale, in particular US databases, where they have been asking the same questions of the same cohorts of children now for 40 years.
So you're saying the data is telling us that addiction to substance abuse, to alcohol, to cigarettes dropped by half, more or less by half. All these things are falling away, which all sounds terrific.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, what are the stats telling us about teenage mental health over the same period?
So we've known for a long time that a consequence of addiction of any description is that it will flow through to anxiety and depression. It is a natural flow through. The biochemistry is really clear. You're not going to get any dispute from any biochemist or neuroscientist about that. Addiction leads to anxiety and depression. So you would expect that if everything is halving over a time frame, then the rates of adolescent anxiety and depression should also be halving. That hasn't happened. And that hasn't stayed the same either. It's doubled. So in the same time frame that the cause of teen anxiety, or a primary driver of teen anxiety and depression, has halved, it has doubled. And that tells us immediately something else is replacing it. It's not that people have suddenly become aware of addiction and stopped doing it. It's not that we've suddenly become risk-averse and that we're all afraid of undertaking these activities. It's that something else is replacing that addiction, and it is an addiction itself because the consequences are the same.
So this has all coincided with the introduction of the smartphone, the iPhone, and portable tablets and similar devices. That seems to be like a powerful coincidence.
It is a powerful coincidence.
Can you make that connection, though, between the introduction of devices that are on all the time and around us all the time to this decline in other forms of addictive behaviour and the rise in mental illness?
The only thing that would make that connection is biochemistry. Is there a reasonable mechanism that would cause this to be the case? And the answer is the science is starting to provide fairly definitive yes to that. really, when you start to think about it, it's not a surprise, and I'll come back to that. It is now clear that software is designed to be addictive. There's whole parts of the software industry whose focus is nothing else, and there's a very, very good reason for that. There are hundreds of millions of companies competing to make sure their app is one of the five you have on your home screen, and in particular, that their app is the one you click 10, 15, 20, or 1,000 times a day. And they have 100 million competitors minimum. There are billions of dollars aimed at making all those free apps be the one you click. And if they didn't try to hook up to human addictive behavior to do that, they'd be insane. They'd be commercially nuts.
This is similar to what goes on with the pokies. We know this happens with the pokies too, that poker machines are designed to have this mesmeric effect on people and keep them sitting there for hours and hours at a time going donk, 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 pressing the same button again and again and again, feeding more money into the machine. This process and of creating some kind of mesmeric addiction.
It's a well-established scientific field, which is what do you do to make someone keep pressing that button? Every time they press that button, they're getting a hit of dopamine. How do you make that happen in their brain? Because if you can't make that happen, they will not press that button. Great experiment, I mean, in rats admittedly, but great experiment where they disabled the dopamine receptors in a rat's brain. Otherwise, normal rats. Disabled them. The rat was still inclined to eat if you put food in its mouth, but it certainly wasn't going to get up and do it. It wasn't going to do anything to get the food. That is an indicator of what we're talking about. Dopamine motivates us. It makes us do things to get reward. And the gaming industry, as well as the software industry, have studied intensely what are the tricks that you have to use there. So things like not always getting the reward. The near-miss phenomena, which is when you, say, on a pokie, when you get three out of the four required things, you feel like you almost got it, almost got there, and if you just press it one more time, you'll surely get it. It isn't any more valuable than getting none out of the four things that are required, but the near-miss works on our brain. The near-miss enhances the effect of the dopamine hit, and it is well-established, behavioural science. This has all been very heavily studied, particularly for gaming, but now much more intensely in the software industry, who are trying to achieve the same things in other kinds of simulation.
On the cover of your book, you've got a boy on a game and a girl on her smartphone. Is this a gendered thing? Are these things created and engineered with gender differences in mind?
Absolutely. Because there's a different hormone makeup in the adolescent teen brain. So girls are much more highly rewarded by oxytocin, which is a hormone that rewards community. It rewards being in a group of people who like you. In real life, what that means is that girls are rewarded if they socialize with a group of girls, preferably, or other people who think they're a good person. So every time they get feedback that they're liked by their group, they get an oxytocin hit. Oxytocin translates into a dopamine reward. So it is rewarding. And there's probably a very good evolutionary reason for that, which is that humans work better in groups. For whatever reason, it's more powerful in women. And men are much, much less sensitive to this. Now, a teenage girl is as sensitive as she will ever be in her entire life to the effects of oxytocin.
And this is what creates, this has led to the creation of what you call approval porn.
Approval porn. Now, until now, we've never successfully simulated that hit. We've simulated other things. A pen and paper can simulate actual porn, sexual porn. Someone can draw sex, and that's a simulation of sex, and it's a rewarding one. But we've never successfully simulated that approval hit you get from meeting and having real people like you. That is approval porn when you can manage to simulate that. And what we've done with social media software like Instagram and Facebook and you name it, all the ones that have likes and comments are high-speed simulators of social approval. And girls really, really respond to that, which is why they're the biggest user group. That doesn't mean boys don't. It just means girls are more likely to, and that's where you'll be more likely to find them.
How about the boys?
Now, the boys respond to a completely different kind of porn, which is what I call danger porn. So we find, strangely, danger rewarding as well. It's what drives the gambling industry, the potential loss, the risk of loss. We find the relief of surviving something rewarding.
Yeah, it's roller coasters, essentially.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, a roller coaster. A simulation of that besides gambling is, of course, online gaming, particularly the latest version of online gaming. And remember, they've been evolving along with us. So the latest version of online gaming is what's called the first-person shooter, which is you are the person. You are seeing a 3D world around you in much the same way as a person would experience. Those games are all designed around the concept of danger porn, which is survival and the relief of survival.
Yep, I was playing games like that in the 90s, like Doom and then Quake. That was first-person shoot-em-up sort of thing. It seems to me like the difference between that and games like Fortnite now,
yeah,
there's a social component there that's plugged into it.
There is that, which is a powerful part of it. There's also another part, which is that the graphics have significantly improved. It has to be a close approximation of the real world, or it isn't convincing. And the other thing is lots of little things that you don't see about the way the game works. So the way the rewards are structured, the way the team interaction is structured, and the way your survival is structured. They're all very, very finely tuned to make sure they're hitting exactly the sweet spot of your dopamine reward system.
There used to be a joke going around in the 90s that you know you're addicted to Doom when you go bashing into the walls at Kmart looking for blue energy pellets. Yeah, and I kind of actually know what that feeling is like, strangely enough, until I sort of gave those games away.
I'm not saying those games weren't addictive, just that they've gotten a lot better.
Yeah, but the other thing it seems like with a game like Fortnite is that you're expected to show up at a certain time.
Yes.
Like if your team in Fortnite is communicating and saying, 7 a.m, we're going on a mission together. Mm-hmm. You've got to be there, otherwise you've let everyone down.
Try telling a boy to stop playing Fortnite in the middle of a mission. Impossible. They will freak out because their team will be let down if they leave.
The game is free. How does it make money?
That's the extraordinary bit, and it makes a lot of money, hundreds of millions of dollars. It does it by allowing you to buy dances. When you kill someone, you do a victory dance, and you can buy variations of that victory dance.
That sounds so lame.
You buy them for $8 a go, and people love it. You buy costumes for your characters. None of this improves the performance of your character, just the look of it, and yet it makes hundreds of millions of dollars.
These tablets are now in schools.
Yep.
In fact, schools are really encouraging, in many cases, students to bring a tablet to school with them. What's the rationale that you've heard for that?
I would go further than encouraging. Many schools are requiring students to have these things instead of textbooks often. Often the justification is, well, you don't have to lug around all these heavy textbooks. You can just have a tablet and then you can have access to it all.
That's fair enough. I mean, I think that's certainly true. It's nice not to have to carry a stack of books in a rucksack.
It is. And if all that thing was ever used for was textbooks, then I would have zero problem with it. If all that thing was what are they called? A Kindle or something.
Reader, yeah.
If that's what it was, zero problem. Good on them. It's what that device is capable of when it's not being used for a textbook that's the problem, which is it can be loaded up with loads of free software that is highly addictive and engineered to addict. And that's the problem. And the reason it's a problem in today's society is because it gives the kid a reason to be on the device. When they come home and you say, I'm locking the device in a cupboard, they can quite reasonably say to you, I need it to do my homework. And they're telling the truth. That makes policing these things almost impossible.
Yeah, you have to stand over their shoulders to make sure that they're doing it, or stand in their bedroom.
And who wants to do that?
No one wants to do that. No.
You know, it adds a layer of complexity to parenting that makes the whole gig hard.
Sometimes I see the rationalizations that go into that from educational institutions, and it's along the lines of, we do need to teach kids computer skills. And I keep thinking, the one thing you don't need to teach kids that they're prepared to find absolutely on their own is computer skills.
Well, and it's a ridiculous argument, because in real workplaces, they're using Word 2010, for example, or whatever it is. Technology doesn't change that fast. Yet on the devices they're using, what they know how to use today will be different by next Tuesday. You know, they're constantly re-engineering the software. And as you say, Gen Z, this current generation of adolescents, have known nothing else in their entire lives. Saying that they need to be taught how to use a computer device is like saying that you and I need to be taught how to breathe.
Turn the tap on.
That's right. Yeah,
have a shower in the morning. Is there any evidence they improve performance?
None. And that's the really shocking
really?
Part.
Seriously?
Yeah. Really? No, none. So I looked at this when I did the book on schooling, free schools, where I looked at, is there an advantage to using devices in schools? And the answer is, No, except in very limited circumstances.
Podcast, broadcast, and online. This is Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Radio.
We were talking before about schools. Is there any evidence to suggest, though, that having computers in the classroom are of any benefit at all?
So there is evidence that if you have a few computers in a classroom and the children work on them in teams, two or three or four kids at a time, there is a benefit in rote learning type tasks. So multiplication tables, that kind of thing, because they're efficient at testing and re-prompting for those sorts of things. There is absolutely no evidence that one-on-one use of devices in classrooms improves educational outcomes. And our own experience, honestly, as an education system, we're one of the leaders in the world. I mean, for example, in Victoria, according to the statistics, there's 10 computers for every 9 kids in the average classroom, which is ridiculous. We've now got more computers in the classroom than students. If there were any benefit from this, which we've been driving hard towards as a country for the last 5 to 7 years, we would see it by now. and the reality is, not only is there no benefit, there's an argument that it's actually degrading our educational performance.
It has been noted that Steve Jobs, before he died, wouldn't let his own kids use many of these devices. Is that a widespread thing amongst the people who actually know how these devices are made and what goes into them?
Well, there's an old saying, don't get high on your own supply. And I think that's what's going on in the tech industry. The people making this stuff know it's addictive. They know it's addictive because they spend all day making it addictive. Increasingly there are stories coming out of the Valley. I mean, that thing about Steve Jobs, that came out by accident in an interview he did when the iPad was released. They asked, you know, what do your kids think of this? Because they were teenagers at the time. He said, I don't let my kids use this. I thought, well, there's an insight. This guy's trying to sell this thing, and he's straight away saying he doesn't let his kids use it. But now, more recently, there's quite a trend in Silicon Valley for executives to instruct their nannies that their children are not to be allowed anywhere near a device. And in fact, there's a subculture of people reporting nannies seen in public places, either on a device themselves or letting a child near a device. It's very much the case that people who are building this stuff are not prepared to let their children use it.
I'm just thinking, you know, in the 19th century, it was a kind of a caricature that rich people were obese and poor people were very thin.
Yes.
And then it flipped around.
Yes.
Exactly the other way around. And similarly, it seems that we're moving, I saw a New York Times article about this, that we're moving to a world where rich people are less likely to give devices to their kids.
Yep.
And then it's the other way around for people on low incomes.
Yeah, rich people can afford to have humans interact with their children, and they regard it as a low-class behaviour, apparently, to have a screen do it. And that's an interesting trend in society.
So they can pay for all these alternatives, like skiing holiday or something like that instead.
Yeah, or a pony or whatever.
Or a private school with a private pool, a pool in it,
and increasingly, every now and then, you see stories cropping up, even in Australia now, of this or that private school banning the use of devices. Quite a few have come up just this year. Private schools in Australia banning the use of devices. I'm not seeing public schools do the same thing.
You say all these changes have taken place in recent years. They've all coincided with a new style of parenting, a new kind of ideology of parenting. That's really quite a recent thing. What is that change?
So we're now in the thick of child-centered parenting, and there could be lots of reasons for this. You could make any number of guesses. There's been a significant change in the demographics of our population since the Second World War.
Fewer children in a family?
Half the number of children in a family. The much higher likelihood that both of the parents are working in a family. The time required to run the household dropping incredibly from 50 hours a week down to 14 hours or less now because of all the labour-saving devices, etc., and the need because both parents are working. So all of those things could be contributing to this, but the end result is quite clear, which is that we have very much a wave of child-centred parenting. And now, what child-centred parenting means is that what the child wants, the child gets. And you have a generation of parents, the parents of Gen Zs, who are usually incapable of saying no. And the reason for that is they have very little time with their smaller number of children, and they probably don't want to spend that time fighting with them. They'd rather have peace and happiness. And the end result is that you have a generation that have been raised and rarely heard the word no by a generation of parents who see a device as a babysitter.
So what happens when a parent who hates saying no tries to tell their kid to stop playing Fortnite until 2 a.m.?
Yeah, well, what happens then is they get a reaction like you would get from any addict when you try to take something away from them, which is that they react sometimes, well, if they're a boy, probably violently, and if they're a girl, probably emotionally violently.
Or with vile abuse.
Yes, exactly. So, and that is what you would expect if you removed a supply from any addict. And the difference is that the first time you do that, it will be that ugly. The second time you do that, it will be almost as ugly. But the 10th time you do that, they will start to realize you mean it, as long as you are consistent, and it will get less ugly.
I have to tell you, David, you're not real popular with my daughter.
Popular with mine.
Sweet Poison, which meant, yeah, right, which was, I mean, you know, you've got to take the Nutella out of the, and other super sweet substances out of the pantry. And it's like, oh, I said, I'm talking to David Gillespie. And she said, oh, what's he on about this time? And I said, screen. She goes, I knew it. Her question to you is, are you Amish? Are you Amish, David? Are you Amish?
No, I'm not Amish. I'm not Amish. In fact,
nothing wrong with being Amish, but are you? I mean, I'm just saying
not,
that.
I think computers are very, very valuable. I work with computers. I have been involved in companies that design software. So I think they're very valuable and they have their place. But that place isn't in the hands of a teenager at midnight in their bed.
So what is to be done? What is to be done about this, to your mind? And what can be done? Realistically, what can be done? Particularly, well, I mean, this is the world we live in at the moment. You mentioned there this time poor parents. It used to be one income. One parent working 40 hours a week was required to sustain a family of five, maybe.
Yes.
Right. Yep. Now both parents need to contribute something at least like 80 hours a week,
yes,
to the workforce to be able to afford an impossibly high mortgage.
Yep.
To house their children and then feed them as well and provide for all those other things.
Yes.
And if it's a single parent, well, it's much, much harder, of course. And this is the world we live in now.
Yeah.
You know, maybe we've made it this way, but most people haven't, of course. This is the world they've inherited.
Well,
So realistically, what can be done in these circumstances?
The realistically part of that is the tricky bit, which is what I would love to say, what I would love to do and what I would love to say to other parents is throw the things in the bin. Take the iPad, throw it in the bin, never let it be seen ever again in your life. That would be the easy answer. The kid would freak out for a week or two, but then they'd be bored and then they'd find something else to do. That will be fine. That will be a perfect answer. Unfortunately, I cannot do that even with my own kids.
Why not?
Because their school requires them to have this device.
Really? You've tried?
Yeah. Well, you can't take it away because they need it. They actually do need it for their schoolwork. Because they don't have any textbooks, all of their work is delivered electronically, all of their assessment is uploaded electronically, it is embedded as part of the education system, which is bad news given that it's at the exact moment that their brains are most susceptible to this. If this was something occurring with adults, I'd say, well, that's unfortunate, but not necessarily bad in terms of ongoing consequence. But we're actually talking here about something that causes very real disease consequences. Anxiety and depression in teenagers is not a joke, and it is a very real consequence of these devices addicting those teens. And yet the devices themselves are required by the institution they attend at that age. It's a bizarre confluence of effect.
Have you tried taking on schools with this?
Absolutely.
Did you get any allies?
Not a lot. We tried with our primary school resisting. So a primary school wanted to have the whole year level have devices. It's a public school. They can't make us have it. So we said we weren't. And then we were called in and told if we did not have the devices, we would be the only ones who didn't. And so the kids may well, you know, it might be better for the kids if they're put into, a mixed class or a different class that didn't have the devices, etc. And in the end, I guess we caved. We decided, look, I guess we have to do this.
So, what can you do then about that device? How do you constrain the use of it?
So, you can't just throw it in the bin, but you can do the next best thing. It's not perfect, but it's what we do, which is have the devices in a central location in the house, have them charged in a central location in the house, have it a requirement, a house rule in your house that they do not leave that stand except for work purposes. And when they are being used for schoolwork, which they inevitably will be, that is being done in a public place where you could see what's on the screen at any time, not in a place where you have to stand there watching it the entire time, but just that you could walk past any minute and you could see what was on the screen. The other thing we do is completely ban the devices during holidays. So no device use during holidays at all, because there is no justification for having them during the holidays. So we can shut them down. And it is an interesting thing to do. Because it's ugly at first.
Yeah. Yeah. I've certainly tried this myself on holidays too. And you really do feel the burn for
absolutely.
Like rage.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. You get rage straight away and you get very, very ugly teenagers.
And I have to admit, in those periods of rage, I have thought in the past, this smells like addiction to me.
Yeah.
Without wanting to think too hard about that.
Well, and all of us are afraid to use the addiction terminology. It sounds so full on when you're talking about a piece of software. But the biochemistry tells us there's no difference. The biochemistry of what's going on in the human brain, about how dopamine works, about how our addiction set points are managed within the brain, it all is exactly the same.
And this is openly acknowledged by the people making this stuff.
Absolutely. It's designed that way, on purpose. They want it to do that, because if they don't do that, you won't use it. I guarantee you, you could release a non-addictive version of name your social media software tomorrow by simply disabling the like and comment feature. No one would use it, but it would be non-addictive. It would have all the same other features, just no likes and comments, and no one would touch it.
It's a hard ask for single parents, this, isn't it?
It's very hard. I'm not suggesting any of this is easy, but I am suggesting that it's necessary.
As you're saying this, as you said, put the iPad in the bin, I just flinched a bit then. I thought, but it's so beautiful.
It is beautiful technology, and it's designed to be beautiful and attractive and easy to use and Moorish.
I'm trying to give up Twitter at the moment too. It's hard, but I'm trying to, and I'm wondering about myself. Are these things any more addictive to adults as they are compared to teenagers?
Adults can be addicted to this kind of software just as easily as teenagers can. The difficulty, though, is teenagers are much more prone to addiction. They don't have when an adult finds something interesting and rewarding and feels attracted to it, they keep going at it for a little while, but then their GABA system kicks in and starts damping it down and breaking it. It controls our impulses. It controls our reward sensations. It damps it down. It makes sure we get a reward earlier, and we shut down that system. That's missing in teenagers, and that's the dangerous bit. Now, the interesting thing is when you look at something specific where there's been really high-quality studies, like on alcohol addiction, for example, in teenagers, and you can see this happening in real time. And what it shows is because the braking system is shut down, a teenager can get a lot drunker than an adult and still look sober. Still behave sober. They don't stagger, they don't fall down, they don't vomit, they don't go to sleep. Where an adult would be asleep after five or six drinks, a teenager is still going strong and looking completely unimpaired and feeling unimpaired, but just as drunk until they're comatose. And that is the difference in the wiring of the brain. And the science is really starting to catch up on that and say, you know, when you talk about the way the brain works, you've got to be really clear about what kind of brain you're talking about. Are you talking about an adolescent brain, or are you talking about an adult brain? Because the wiring is very different.
What about the bargaining? What about meeting them halfway? What if you just said, you know, you can still have it, just keep it down to an hour a day?
Yeah. Substitute the word cigarette into that question and see if that works for you.
Vodka.
Or vodka. Look, I'm cutting back
on
your
vodka. Just 1 hour a day on the vodka, and that's it.
That's all you get.
Right.
Right? And look, if you're really good all week, you can have vodka all weekend. And as soon as you do that, as soon as I say that to another parent, they realize the insanity of what you're talking about when you talk about negotiating addiction. You can't negotiate with addiction. It is addiction. It's a biochemical process.
I have been the one in my family to make sort of these sweeping, ruling out edicts in my family. I found, you know, Saturday morning when our kids were young, you know, you really do like your sleep in on Saturday morning. I was quite happy for my daughter to watch cartoons for a bunch of hours. I have happy memories of watching Saturday morning cartoons for myself from my own childhood. But I would find that once we did get up, you know, the kid would be listless and irritable,
yes,
after 3 hours of cartoons, and would not want to do anything. Like, we get him to say, hey, let's go and do this. No. Let's go out and do that. No. Let's go and do this. And so I banned Saturday morning cartoons, and I was accused of being a jihadist, an extremist, but I did it. I insisted on it. And I found, after all the ranting and raving, my daughter would get up in the morning and she'd make some cookies. She'd make some biscuits. She would potter around. She'd do some drawing, and she would hum while she was doing these, and she'd be up for stuff later in the day. This is what I found was on the other side of that ugly withdrawal period.
And that's what we find as well, is that on the other side of banning devices for the holiday is bored kids initially, but then kids who find something else to do, go to the beach, go to the movies, actually go out and interact in real life. And I guess coming back to the first things we were discussing about addictions dropping off, the things that have dropped off are the things that require you to be physically present. The things that have increased are the ones that you can do from the safety of your bedroom. And so, ironically, the trend in parenting towards cotton-balling your kids and keeping them safe has actually exposed them to a far greater danger. And the interesting thing is, instead of it just being the adventurous few who become addicted to things as teenagers, it becomes every teenager. This is an experiment on a scale we have never seen before in the human race. Let's see what happens when we expose every single member of a generation to a highly addictive thing and see what happens after that. I think we're in for a real tidal wave of problems, not the least of which is the opioid addiction developing in the United States at the moment, because all of these addictions have a gateway effect to other kinds of addiction.
It seems like you're saying two things here. You're saying that kids recover from this, but yes, then you say if they've done it for too long, they're prone to lifelong problems.
The problem with it, with the biochemistry, is that the brain compensates. So what they found, particularly with alcohol addiction in teenagers, is that if a teen is binge drinking on a regular basis, the brain says, oh, okay, because what alcohol does is actually promote GABA, it actually increases the braking system perversely, but what it does is do it artificially. And the brain then says, okay, well, I don't need that anymore. I don't need to make it anymore. I don't need to build that system. And so the result is they go into adulthood with an adolescent GABA control system, which means they're in that impaired braking system state for the rest of their life. And that's why the stats show that if you first become addicted to alcohol as a teenager, you are 2 to 3 times more likely to remain addicted for the rest of your life.
I'm looking at your list of recommendations here.
Yep.
It's pretty categorical. Here we go. No private screen time.
Yep.
No internet-enabled phones. What, using the old... Oh, well, I'm going to say old-fashioned.
Our kids just love us for the flip phones we make them use.
So you can get texts,
You can get texts. That's it.
Okay. Yeah. No social media. No games. No purchasing capability. Online shopping gives you these little hits as well.
Yeah, interestingly, there's been quite a lot of research into this, particularly because it's got a double hit effect. There's the hit of shopping, which in itself is rewarding. So finding a bargain, getting something, it's a kind of primitive version of approval porn, where you're buying something that will increase your value to your friends in a way. And therefore get their approval. Online shopping does that. But the interesting thing about online shopping is that because it's also got the random element of when it will actually be delivered, because certainty decreases addictive capability, as the gambling industry will tell you, there's uncertainty about when the goods will actually arrive. And that is just as stimulating as buying the thing in the first place.
The final thing you say is you're going to need to find something else to do with all the time your child now has because they're not glued to a screen. I'm conscious as we're talking that, as you know, the audience listening to this, there's going to be some scenes tonight. There's going to be some scenes after people have heard this. What do you advise the parents to do during those scenes that will happen this afternoon and this evening?
Remember that the person you're talking to has impaired impulse control. That's another aspect of this. The braking system turns off the impulse control. Do not react in the moment. Stay cool. Back off. They will recover. Talk in the calm light of the following day. But stick to your guns. Don't be whined out of it.
If I offered your kids equal time to come on in the next couple of days, would they say similar things? What would they say?
They would say the same thing any kid who would say, and the same thing any addict would say, which is that I am completely insane and there's nothing wrong with their screen time and I need to get over it. That's what any kid would say. Exactly what they used to tell me about sugar, by the way.
It's been a pleasure to speak with you, as always, David, and thank you so much.
Love being here.
David Gillespie's new book is called Teen Brain, Why Screens Are Making You a Teenager Depressed, Anxious, and Prone to Lifelong Addictive Illnesses, and How to Stop It. David Gillespie's conversation with me will be available for you soon as a podcast. You can get it from wherever you get your podcasts from the ABC Listen app, from iTunes, or from wherever you like, pretty much. It's all over the place. And you can find them all on our website as well, abc.net.au/conversations. I'm Richard Feidler. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more Conversations interviews, please go to the website abc.net.au/conversations.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.